And we return. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman with you on this soggy Monday afternoon. If you're on the road, please be careful because the thunderstorms are quite prolific
today. Yeah, they weren't supposed to be so bad, but they are.
Well, today we visit with prolific author and Temple University English professor Joan Mellon. Her latest work deals with the CIA, the Cuban Revolution, Bay of Pigs, Missile Crisis, and the FBI. It's called The Great Game in Cuba, How the CIA Sabotaged Its Own Plot to Unseat Fidel Castro. And Joan Mellon joins us from West Windsor, New Jersey. Welcome to you, Joan. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you.
Hi. Hi, Professor.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. You devote so much of your book to the Texan Robert J. Clayburgh, Jr., and it's not a name we usually hear in the context of Cuba. Tell us about him, his ranch, his aspirations, and how it relates to Cuba.
Clayburgh seemed to be, first of all, when I heard his name, I didn't know who he was. And it turns out that he's probably an important historical figure in the United States. It's just that he didn't want anyone to know about him, and he stayed under the radar of history. Clayburgh ran the largest ranch in the United States and ultimately in the world when he started. The best way to think of Clayburgh, if you know the movie Giant, which starred Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor and James Dean, that figure Edna Ferber wrote about was based on Clayburgh. And Clayburgh did not appreciate her, and she wrote a very nasty revenge book called Giant. Clayburgh really didn't want, he didn't like what he called lady writers. Clayburgh really only cared about cattle, and he wasn't interested in money, he wasn't interested too much in profit, but to pay off his grandmother's inheritance taxes, he had to lease some of the King Ranch land to Humble Oil. For 6 years, they got nothing, dry wells, and then suddenly all the wells came in, and he had so much money he didn't know what to do with it. His relatives, who partly owned King Ranch with him, wanted dividends. Clayburgh gave them nothing. Instead, he decided to develop satellite ranches all over the world. And his aim was to feed the world's hungry. His aim was to create energy through people eating beef. In those days, beef was considered the best thing you could eat, the best nutrient. And one of his ranches was in Cuba. And he went into partnership with the Braga brothers, who ran a sugar emporium there in Cuba. And everything was going well. He didn't take a cent of profit out of Cuba. And then, of course, came Fidel Castro.
Usually,
at first they... Yeah,
oh, go ahead. No, go ahead. You go ahead.
I'm saying, at first, the Clayburgh and his right-hand man, whose name was Michael J.P. Malone, another important historical figure people don't know about, they thought that Castro would be fine with their operation. They had cleared the land of all the marabou, which is sort of like mesquite. They brought equipment. They brought the cattle and ships and airplanes. And then it didn't work out that way. Castro targeted it was called Becerra, King Ranch in Cuba. And Clayburgh didn't much like that.
Of course, Clayburgh's name is spelled K-E-L-B-E-R-G. He's so far under the radar, at least for me. I've been here over 35 years that I had to call someone to get the correct pronunciation.
You have it right. You have it exactly right. Clayburgh.
So he developed a close relationship with Cuban native Alberto Fernandez. At the time, he was a leader in the sugar industry in Cuba. Describe Fernandez and their relationship.
Alberto Fernandez was a very rich man in Cuba. He'd been educated in the United States. He went to Choate, where he was a classmate of John F. Kennedy. Then he went on to Princeton and went back to Cuba to run several ranches and sugar operations that he had in Cuba. Clayburgh came down, and the person who would inform him of what it was like to raise cattle in Cuba was Fernandez. And so they developed a very close relationship, that's true. And then when it all went for... Fernandez ultimately had to leave Cuba in the last days of the Batista regime. The Batista people were harassing him, and he left and went to Florida and lived in Key Biscayne. And when Castro took power, by the way, I should say also that people like Fernandez and the other character in the book too, Gustavo de los Reyes, didn't know what Castro was going to do, and they were so happy to get rid of the tyranny of Batista that they were willing to give Castro a chance. And Alberto Fernandez even collected money in the United States for the 26th of July movement. He went back to Cuba in January of 1959, right after Castro took power, and he ran the sugar industry for Castro for one, what he called one crop, which is part of a year. And then he didn't like what he saw, and he saw that Castro was not living up to the ideals that he had promised to live by.
Did Clayburgh and Batista have any relationship?
Well, there's one scene in the book where when Clayburgh first goes to Cuba, he has breakfast with Batista. And he's wearing, and then he goes to visit Alberto Fernandez, and he's wearing the khakis and a white shirt, which were his standard uniform. He gets off the plane, and Batista's soldiers are at the airport, and they begin to ready to arrest him because only Batista people could wear khakis and a white shirt or whatever. And Fernandez was laughing. He said, if you arrest that man, you'll be arresting somebody who had breakfast this morning with President Batista. So he knew he had contact with Batista. But Clayburgh was a very liberal man, although you wouldn't think he voted Republican. He voted Democrat and Republican. These people are beyond party specificities like this. And so at that moment, when he went to Cuba, the Batista regime was fine. He was adding to the wealth of Cuba and what he was doing, building a ranch like that. There was nothing like it in Cuba.
Who were the Unidad Revolucionaria?
So then shortly after Castro took power, one of the comandantes in 26th of July, who Castro had named the head of the agriculture and who had written the penal code for 26th of July, whose name was Humberto Sori Marin, another name that most people don't know outside maybe of Florida. And Sori was appalled by the way what Castro was doing, the executions, the arrests. And so he slowly, quietly began to create a movement called Unidad Revolucionaria. And he enlisted Alberto Fernandez in that. And he got quite a big following for that. And he wanted to create a liberal revolutionary government in Cuba. He did not want to, he was not a communist, but he was not a Batistiano either. And this movement started to grow.
Did Clayburgh, by any chance, have any relationship with the mafia, who, of course, were outraged that Castro expropriated their casinos and hotels?
None. Clayburgh did not suffer fools gladly, was not selfish. All he really cared about was cattle. And there's a wonderful scene that I was able to capture when Michael J.P. Malone, who had worked for the Braga Brothers Sugar Company, came to King Ranch as the representative of the Bragas, and Clayburgh said to him, I want you to be president of the ranch in Cuba. And Malone, who had five CIA handlers, by the way, said, I don't know anything about cattle. And Clayburgh said, I'll handle the cattle. You'll handle everything else. I'll deal with it. And it turned out that what Malone wound up dealing with was getting people out of prison, saving people's lives, and after Castro took power. So, yes.
Now, Clayburgh was a close friend of both Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA, and the director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. Did they assist him in getting Becerra returned to him after it was confiscated by Castro?
They did not.
Why?
And Dulles is such a strange figure, and it's hard. I don't think anyone has given us a good analysis of Alan Dulles. Why shouldn't you think that he would? And Clayburgh thought that he would help out. And Clayburgh was shocked to find that Alan Dulles had no interest in helping. See, and I figured after studying CIA for a very long time, what I found out was that the first loyalty of CIA was to CIA. Not to the United States, which they thought of CIA as the United States. And not to anyone else, and not to people who were fighting dictatorships, not to people who were looking for democracy. No, no. All they wanted was to enhance their own power, enhance their budget, enhance their espionage capabilities, show their strength. And so Cuba finally was not of interest to them, too small. They had other fish to fry, and those fish were in Vietnam. And so you begin to see CIA retreating from helping anybody in the anti-Castro movement. I know people might not like to say that, but that's what I found. I found when I was interviewing Alberto Fernandez over years, I found when I was interviewing another figure in the movement called Gustavo de los Reyes, who went to Dalandala, who was a rancher also, and he started a movement among cattlemen against Castro. And De Los Reyes, along with Malone, went to visit Allen Dulles in Washington and asked for his help. And Dulles discouraged him. And then finally, as I say, as shown in the book, there's a non sequitur in which Dulles suddenly says to Gustavo De Los Reyes, "How much money do you need?" And then De Los Reyes is shocked. He says, "We don't want your money. I came here to inform you of what we're doing." And Dulles says, "Well, you're going to wind up either in a prison or a cemetery." And De Los Reyes says, "I would rather be in a prison or a cemetery than do nothing."
Tell us why you use the term CIA and don't include the CIA.
Well, if you had anyone on, we had anyone on here with us from CIA, they would say, "See, that's how they speak of themselves. They don't say the CIA." It's anyone who writes a book that's from the CIA, unless their publisher tells them people won't understand. It's their internal locution. It's the way they talk about themselves. Mm-hmm. So I thought, although I had some trouble, and if you look at the title of the book, it says how the CIA mm-hmm. sabotaged its own plot, because they wouldn't let me do it on the cover because they were afraid people would think it's a mistake. It's not a mistake.
Right.
We're speaking with Joan Mellon, professor of English and creative writing at Temple University and author of her latest book, The Great Game in Cuba, How the CIA Sabotaged Its Own Plot to Unseat Fidel Castro. It's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. I'm joined by Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper here, and we resume our conversation with Joan Mellon. She's written The Great Game in Cuba. Joan, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your books?
Oh, I have my new website, www.joanmellon.com. And Mellon is spelled M-E-L-L-E-N.
If you'd like to join in with a question or comment about the book Great Game in Cuba, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email. That's radio@wlrn.org. Joan, could you give us a little bit of a capsule of the history of Texas's famous Brown and Root and also Halliburton?
Yes. Well, I was going to write a book about Texas and CIA, and one of the chapters was going to be about George and Herman Brown and how they started out from nothing, and Herman Brown was paving roads, and eventually they became the biggest contractor, I guess, in the United States and operated internationally and eventually were hired to build bases. And when the Vietnam War came, in 1962, Brown and Root was sold to Halliburton at the moment of Herman Brown's death. And from that moment, when the United States went into Vietnam, Brown and Root were given most of the contracts, construction contracts, building ports, building roads, building bridges, and they became enormously incalculable wealth went to Brown and Root, and we can see the role of Brown and Root later in Iraq and other efforts. They built all the air bases in Spain. They built them in Guam. They built them everywhere in the world. They represented the defense contracting arm of the United States. And I should also say that in the old days, when Herman Brown started and when his brother George joined him, the work was impeccable. And during Hurricane Katrina, the bridge, if everyone has been to New Orleans, knows there's that 24-mile span across Lake Pontchartrain. And in New Orleans, except for the WPA projects, that was the only span in the New Orleans, including everything over the Mississippi River, that was not broken by Hurricane Katrina. Not a crack. So their work was truly extraordinary. They didn't get where they were from because they did shoddy work. But what happened to Brown and Root, Herman and George Brown became the benefactors in the late 1930s of Lyndon Johnson. And that also, when Lyndon Johnson became president, the facilitating of the Vietnam War was on the table. He had no choice about that. and the difference between President Kennedy and President Johnson. And I think we could see this, for example, in the autobiography of McGeorge Bundy, Lessons in Disaster, I think it's called, which was published after his death by his co-author. Kennedy, every day, practically, members of Kennedy's cabinet would be begging, send some troops to Vietnam, send ground troops to Vietnam. And Kennedy had to stand up to old McNamara, Rusk, McGeorge Bundy himself, and refused all the way down the line. He just refused. And when once Kennedy is dead, here comes Johnson, the favorite child of Herman and George Brown, and he immediately accelerated that war. You can see it on the table. So the people who expected CIA to help out with Cuba to facilitate the overthrow of Fidel Castro were going to be disappointed. That was not going to happen.
You talk about Umberto Sori Marin, and he met with the CIA to discuss the logistics of the Bay of Pigs invasion, in particular the landing location. What happened?
Well, Alberto Fernandez had a ship. He was called the Man of the Boats, and he had a boat called the Tejana, which is, by the way, Texas. And he exfiltrated Sori Marin from Cuba in early March of 1961 and brought him to Key Biscayne and in Florida, and met with people in Miami at JM Wave, the CIA station. And Sori brought with him a plan for what an effective invasion of Cuba would be. I include the plan in the book in Spanish because I wanted people to see it, and I didn't want to fool around with the translation. So it's in the book in Spanish, and he explained that it was certain disaster to land on the Zapata Peninsula. Everybody knew it. And he thought when he went back, he insisted on returning to Cuba, and of course was captured and executed. But he was certain that when he had left, the CIA wasn't honest. They didn't tell him that they weren't going to abide by, weren't going to listen to what he said. And it wasn't only Sori Marin who knew that this was a surefire disaster at the Bay of Pigs, that it could never have succeeded. There's a scene in the book where at Kennedy's special group, his intelligence people are sitting around, Dulles is there, and General Edward Lansdale comes in, and he's listening to all of this. He's famous for guerrilla warfare in the Philippine Islands. He's the Quiet American in Graham Greene's book. And he sat there, and he says, finally, he burst out, "You're going to get clobbered." And Dulles told him to be quiet in deference to past favors, something like that. And it was clear to anybody who knew anything about guerrilla warfare, any kind of warfare, that this was a certain disaster. It was going to be terrible. And Dulles went ahead anyway and lied about it, of course.
Again, our number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also radio at WLRN.org by email. First up,
and by the way, I want to add one thing. And that many people blame President Kennedy for not continuing the air cover that would have helped at the Bay of Pigs. But I don't know. People more in tune with military matters would know. I don't think it would have mattered. It was that bad.
Well, from your book, it looks like they purposely botched the operation, the CIA.
They wanted to show that they were there, that, you know, that they were going to, and I think they really lied to the Cubans who were working with them.
First caller, Rudy in Miami. Hi.
Yes. Hello. Thank you. The call is just extremely intriguing. I just want to let you know that my grandfather was the chief of police of Havana before the Castro regime took over. And I can only say that some of my neighbors, many of them from West Miami, were part of some of the Omega situation, Omega 7, you know, which tried to overthrow the Castro regime in the 70s, and they were called terrorists, and they're just got out of jail not too long ago, but that was some of them that got out of jail. And I just want to, give my thanks for this call because it's extremely intriguing, and there's a lot behind the scenes from someone who grew up as a kid listening to these political meetings. And, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. So what was the actual purpose of the invasion at the Bay of Pigs?
That's a good question. I think really it's for CIA to flex its muscles, to show that it's in charge, to show that it's doing something. And it's hard to say because there was no possible chance or idea that there could be a victory here. And Castro had developed by that time a very strong intelligence network, G2. And they captured, the result was that they Castro captured 50,000 or more members of Unidad, which sort of shows that Sory Marin was right and that he was developing a mass movement inside Cuba to provide an alternative to Fidel Castro.
I
know many of us, yeah, go ahead, sorry.
When do you think the real powers that be, such as the Claybergs, realized that Castro was indeed a communist? What showed his hand?
Well, Alberto Fernandez and Humberto Sory Marin saw that he was a communist right away.
Right.
There's a scene in the book where just shortly after Fernandez returns to Cuba and some of Castro's own military tell him, listen, these people are communists. So I think it wasn't a secret. And then, of course, they developed that agrarian reform, INRA, and targeted every – they confiscated not only the holdings of foreign companies, which would include Claybergh's ranch, but also the ranches of Cubans inside Cuba and their property. They took the furniture. They took the photographs. It was ruthless. It was pretty clear. Claybergh was very smart. Of course, he had to remember Michael J.P. Malone. I have to introduce this figure. He was the chief aide to Francis Cardinal Spellman, who was the Archbishop of New York. Then he went to work for the Bragas, and then for Claybergh. He was very close to the FBI and to the CIA, and pretty much knew everything that was going on in Cuba. And try to help in every way he could, try to give money to people who had to leave Cuba. And I think the FBI and the CIA actually held back his name until the 1990s. And only when the papers of some of the figures who were involved in the anti-Castro movement became public, and then you could see his name, then CIA revealed who he was.
Is that huge Claybergh property in Cuba still used agriculturally or for raising cattle?
No. I don't know what it is exactly, but I don't think so. I don't think so. They couldn't maintain it. Claybergh brought all the equipment needed for Cuba. He brought rope. He brought saddles. He brought the plows and the machine he invented to clear the land. I don't think that it. And I can't remember. Somebody told me recently what was going on, but it wasn't anything. It was not a great cattle ranch the way it was then. And the cattle that Claybergh, by the way, I didn't mention this, Claybergh was the first person to invent a new breed of cattle in the United States. And it was called Santa Gertrudis. And when a friend of Claybergh's went to the Soviet Union, this is later, and he suddenly sees all these red cattle, they're bright red cattle, cherry red, and on the hide of the cattle, the brand, some of them had the brand for King Ranch in Texas, and some had the running W for meant that cattle that were born in Cuba. They'd all gone to the Soviet Union, and they were extracted for what Soviet Union wanted to get back from Cuba, what it had given. It was not easy, and it was a Faustian bargain, I think, that Castro had to make with the Soviet Union, or thought he had to make.
So do you think that the reason that they didn't help Alberto Fernandez and Claybergh and the rest of them was because they were afraid of what Russia would do, the CIA? I mean, why else wouldn't they have helped?
I think they wanted to turn their resources to a place where more money could be made by friends like Herman and George Brown, or the Brown and Root, the Halliburton, the Bechtel. It wasn't only Brown and Root. And they saw a protracted war as more useful to them than a quickie that they could succeed in Cuba in a short amount of time. Hmm. And I think it had something to do maybe with their relationships with other Latin American countries. But I think really what George Orwell writes about this in 1984, when he says the kind of war that Big Brother wanted was the war that never ends, the war for which there's no victory, and you keep it going as long as you possibly can. And they were right about that. Look at how long they stayed in Vietnam, a decade in Vietnam or more. And that wouldn't have been the case in Cuba.
We're speaking with Joan Mellon, professor of English at Temple University and the author of The Great Game in Cuba, How the CIA Sabotaged Its Own Plot to Unseat Fidel Castro. Another break on Topical Currents, and we'll be right back.
It is today's topical occurrence, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. And we're speaking with English professor from Temple University, Joan Mellon, very prolific author. Her latest book deals with the Cuban Revolution, the Bay of Pigs, and the CIA, or just CIA. It's called The Great Game in Cuba. And tell me, Joan Mellon, how about the armaments that were used in the Bay of Pigs, that they were carrying like rifles that were antique and just not very well equipped? What's behind that?
Well, the real problem with the Bay of Pigs was that they were landing at a place that they had nowhere to run. They had nowhere to go hide to fight another day. There were no mountains that they could run into and hole up there and wait to fight again. And the weapons were meaningless, I think. And then another thing was that all the weapons, the guns were in one boat and the other things were in another. It was completely disorganized. And they had a ship there that was they used as a decoy. And the people would have been killed as sacrifices to see if not the ship had got lost. And one of the people who were running looked at it and said, wait a minute, and the people were saved. But they couldn't imagine why CIA would treat them that way, why they would jeopardize their lives in that way. Mm-hmm. I can't give a definitive answer on what's going on in CIA minds. But if you look at the current situation in Afghanistan and all in Pakistan, and you can see that they run the show and they don't feel the need to explain anything to anybody. They've never explained this. Dulles, after the Bay of Pigs, said, well, really, it was the military that decided where the landing would be, which is false. What I discovered also in studying this Cuba story is that CIA has the power. Military is their arm. The defense contractors are their clients. The government itself is for show. Elected officials are for show.
How did you get access to these documents and this information about the CIA?
It's available. CIA, under the John F. Kennedy Collections Act, which was passed in 1992 to Lyndon Johnson's, 1992. It was passed in 1992. Never mind Lyndon Johnson for now. The CIA released thousands and thousands of documents. They're not all about the Kennedy assassination. Many of them are about peripheral issues. For example, when Jim Garrison in New Orleans was looking at George Brown and wondering whether George Brown had any, because George Brown was the benefactor of Lyndon Johnson, and Lyndon Johnson was withholding documents from that should have been available from the Warren Commission, when that happened, there were documents generated about Brown and Root. And then CIA admitted in a document that for Herman Brown, as George Brown too, and many executives of Brown and Root, had been assets of the clandestine services of the CIA since the very beginnings.
Joan Mellon.
So this material is out there if journalists would go and look for it.
Right.
Joan Mellon, you've written about Jim Garrison and now also the CIA. Do you find any connection between the CIA and the assassination?
Well, that, the reason I wrote these two books, I wrote one on Haiti and one on Cuba, and I was very interested in CIA because Jim Garrison came to the conclusion that CIA was behind the Kennedy assassination. Now, it's very interesting. In the last 10 years or so, there have been a lot of books written saying Lyndon Johnson was really the mastermind of the Kennedy assassination and his lawyer organized it. And I think that these are efforts of CIA. These books have to be serving CIA to get the heat off them, because there's no mistaking that Lee Harvey Oswald was connected to CIA, to U.S. Customs, and to the FBI. And I found a document which it's not related to any of this, but it shows that Garrison was right about Clay Shaw and that he was an employee of CIA, and it's in a document from the history group of CIA. Now, I happen to have a friend who does a lot of research and who handed me that document. No one else had ever found it, but there it was, issued by CIA. Somehow I think that they feel that they're invulnerable. And if they release all of these documents, they don't have to weed them out, throw them out, destroy them. They release a lot of these documents, and they have no idea what's in their own documents. Because if you put the whole thing together, you can get a very clear picture of what they're about.
Yeah, I would think they wouldn't release documents that would be incriminating, but
they
you say
most
all
many
there.
They haven't. Many they haven't. I should say that we have evidence of them not giving documents, for example, to the Church Committee or to the House Committee, Select Committee on Assassinations, where they hold these documents back. And say, well, we can't release file on Lee Harvey Oswald, so and so. But I think it's if you keep studying, you'll find the connections. They're there.
So going back to Cuba, who was Camilo Cienfuegos?
Camilo Cienfuegos was one of the comandantes. He was perhaps the third most powerful after Fidel Castro and Raúl and Che Guevara came Camilo Cienfuegos. But he was the kindest, I think, the most sympathetic. As you can see from the photograph in the book, but he was loyal to Fidel Castro. But Castro was threatened by him, threatened by his popularity, his humanity, his sympathy, and so Castro sent Camilo Cienfuegos to arrest another comandante who's well known in Miami, Hubert Matos, and Cienfuegos doesn't want to do it. They're friends, but he goes up there and he has him arrested, and then Cienfuegos flies back to Havana, and then the word is out, the party line, if you want to call it that, is that his plane crashed. Cienfuegos' plane crashed.
But you don't think that's what happened?
Well, there's no wreckage found. I mean, he didn't go out to sea. He's just coming from Camagüey to Havana. He's not flying over the ocean, and he's gone, disappeared. But some people, and I got a lot of this from Alberto Fernandez, who got a lot of it, too, from Sorry, Marin, that at a small airfield outside Havana, Cienfuegos lands. And then, and I don't know the source there, except for Sorry, inside the palace, Castro shoots Camilo Cienfuegos. There's a cordon, there's a brought around the palace. It's closed off. No one can enter the area. It's on a weekend. And the body is put in a tank or what a storage and dropped into the ocean.
But if he was loyal.
Now, I believe it. I mean, I cannot prove it. This is not the kind of thing you can, you know, get to sources or anything like that. But I put it in italics in the book, the story, because I believe it. But it's still in italics. It's not 100% true.
Right. But if he was loyal to him and, you know, followed his instruction, why would he have killed him?
He was a rival. I don't think that Cienfuegos was disloyal to Castro.
Right.
It's Castro who's disloyal to Cienfuegos. This has been a mystery of the history of the Cuban Revolution from all these years, since the beginnings. Nobody has given, even the biographer of Cienfuegos, who was editor of the newspaper in Cuba, Revolucion, until he left Cuba too. Doesn't understand what could have happened, and he's not satisfied with the explanation. And the head of the Camagüey Airport, the manager of the Camagüey Airport, is killed a few weeks later after saying that he can't understand how this could have happened, and the investigation was perfunctory. Suddenly he's shot in the head. So that any dissent, see, this is really the truth, and I know that I've angered a lot of people about this book. But I can't help it. I mean, what's true is true. And the people who like CIA won't like this book. The people who like Fidel Castro won't like this book. And there are such people. But finally, if you're telling the story, there's nothing else you can do. I started this story not about Cuba. It was about Clayburgh. And I wondered about who was Robert J. Clayburgh Jr. and how does he figure in American intelligence history? That is because he knew Dulles. How did he get to know Dulles? Why did Dulles fly to King Ranch for advice from Robert J. Clayburgh Jr.? And what I wound up doing was writing about Cuba, because here's Alberto Fernandez, whose name comes to me through the Clayburgh story. And I called him up on the phone in Key Biscayne, and he was already practically 90. And he agreed to talk to me, and I said, this is a person who has a story that's extremely important to history. Nobody has written it. He has never talked to any other author. And so I flew down there and just spent time and came back and back, and we spoke on the phone, and I came back, and I went over it and over it and over it to the best ability that I could. And then Gustavo de los Reyes came into the story, heard about him, and so I put me, because his story is also parallel, because he was also helped by Robert J. Clayburgh Jr. and Malone. And so when De Los Reyes gets out of prison, he was on the Isle of Pines for 4 years. When he gets out of prison, after a period of time, Clayburgh makes him head of his King Ranch in Venezuela. And he, rather than continue the struggle, De Los Reyes goes to Venezuela and I think lives a wonderful life after his terrible years in first in La Cabaña prison, which is beyond belief, and then on the 4 years on the Isle of Pines. Mm. I tell the story in the book of De Los Reyes' name was put on the list of those designed to be executed. And then Clayburgh got him a lawyer who had turned out that this lawyer, Ituria, had represented some Cubans who had been part of the 26th of July and had been captured off the coast of Texas, and he got them off. And so Ituria goes to this tribunal in Havana, and Fidel is sitting there with all the comandantes. It's on the cover of the book, and he's begging for De Los Reyes' life, and Castro says, "If I save one, I have to save all." Whoa. And then, of course, then in deference to Ituria's having gotten those 26th of July fighters out, he doesn't let De Los Reyes go, but he doesn't kill him either.
Right.
Our radio signal on a good day gets into Cuba. I imagine we probably have some interested people listening to us right now.
Oh, I didn't know that you were broadcasting in Cuba.
Well,
I can't
on a good day, our signal reaches there. We've had comments from the island.
I just told the story, the truth, as I was told it, and the documents confirmed it, insofar as I was able to get the documents. And the history of CIA's relationship with Alberto Fernandez and the Tejana is charted in CIA documents because CIA helped him. They were sort of spying on him, and they wanted to control him. What CIA wanted to do with the anti-Castro Cubans was to control them and make them part of a CIA organization called Cuban Revolutionary Council. And throughout the story, you'll see Alberto Fernandez refusing to give up his principles, to give up control of his movement and of leadership to CIA. So they were constantly battling, and he refused to take a salary from CIA or any kind of bonuses, unlike many other people. And he really suffered. He lost everything.
We're speaking with Joan Mellon. Her latest book is The Great Game in Cuba. On Topical Currents, another short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. We resume our conversation with Joan Mellon. She's authored The Great Game in Cuba. If you'd like to join in, we have a few lines open at numbers 1-800-743-9576 or email is radio at WLRN.org. First up, we have Carlos in Kendall. Hi.
Hi. I want to comment on what the professor said at the beginning, why the invasion? And I refer her to the invasion of the planned invasion by the CIA of Guatemala, which toppled Jacobo Arbenz Guzman in 1954. Democratically elected. And in 1961, when President Kennedy had doubts, Robert Dulles writes that Dulles said to President Kennedy, "Believe me, this is easier than Guatemala. We should go ahead with it." So Dulles, who planned the invasion, was all for the invasion, and he believed it was going to be the same as Guatemala and that Cuba would fall.
I want to say that I forgot to say something, and that is CIA has overthrown many governments, and the reason always is the same. In when there's a government that is not hospitable to American business interests, CIA goes in and supports the forces that would be favorable to American business. So that's the general, and that was true in Guatemala, certainly. It was
right.
True in Iraq. It was true in Iran in 1951, when they overthrew Mossadegh. This is their general, basically, their role. So the question about the Bay of Pigs is so confusing because they couldn't win. I don't know what they thought they could blackmail President Kennedy into doing, but he hadn't agreed. And I it was a very dangerous business and very cruel to the people who were fighting on the side of the against Castro.
Yeah, I mean, if that's what they were doing to protect American interests, it doesn't make sense that they wouldn't have wanted to unseat Castro.
Right, but they had, there was no chance. And there's this huge movement in Cuba of Unidad that really had, would have been growing.
Right.
Had Castro not then rounded everyone up and murdered everybody in jail and whatnot, it was devastating. So this is really, I think it shows their true colors, actually. And I think that when I wrote it, I've written a book that makes everybody mad in some ways. But I just, this is, this seems to me that this picture of CIA is the one that we've seen in the last decade as well.
In the book, you say that Castro actually had his own men on the Bay of Pigs invasion vessels.
Oh, sure. I think they, he used the East German model, I gather, for developing his intelligence services and the Soviet. And he met with Mikoyan in Mexico to talk about how to create a police state. He created a police state. It's so hard to think of as even today as that being what Cuba became.
Another Cuban militant you speak of is Dionisio Pastrana. What was his story?
He's a wonderful young man who came out of Cuba and was a student and wanted desperately to overthrow Castro and join the CIA again, join with CIA. And we see his experience in infiltrating to Cuba parallels that of Alberto Fernandez. CIA won't give him the proper weaponry. CIA is not careful about it, about his safety. But one of the things he did was to bring back to the United States some of the skin of the missile that had taken down the American U-2 that was downed in Cuba. And as a result, as the CIA handler says, Dionisio helped in the 1967 war because the Soviet weaponry that was used by Egypt was understood better because of the material that Dionisio brought back to the United States. Dionisio Pastrana is the head of the South Florida Goodwill Industries.
Today.
He's actually a wonderful, kind, humane man and an extraordinary person. And he was a militant and totally idealistic, risked his life over and over again in infiltrating into Cuba, and has such a cheerful nature. He's not bitter at all about CIA malfeasances, and he just smiles rather extraordinary person. You should have him on sometime.
Look into that. Let's see. Let's squeeze in another phone call. We're getting kind of close to the end of our hour. Michael, Miami Beach, you're up. Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to ask the author if she would have the same sentiment I have, that Fidel Castro is not a communist as much as he is a dictator using the communist economic system to have total control of the nation. Because if he left it open, any dollars that wanted to get back in, they'd have the strength of money to try to overthrow him.
Joan, would you comment on that?
I don't think he's a Marxist in the way that some people might think of a Marxist, because a Marxist would have a democratic view of a society, and certainly a society where you express your point of view and you express dissent. And we don't see that in Cuba. And it doesn't seem to come up anymore even.
Juan Carlos writes that as a son of a veteran of the Bay of Pigs invasion, and based on everything that I was told over the last 40 years, I must say that all the information that Professor Mellon states is correct. I can't wait to read the book. That's Juan Carlos.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Wednesday is the anniversary of Bay of Pigs. It would be the 52nd.
Oh, my God, April 17th.
Mm-hmm.
So I have another question. Whatever happened to Robert Clayburg Jr. and all his satellite ranches and his ranch in Texas?
Once he died, all those relatives that were clamoring for the money that he was using to create cattle and create beef for the world hungry, they destroyed the whole system. They sold off the ranches at lower prices than they were worth, and the whole thing has disappeared.
And what happened?
So it's.
I'm sorry,
yeah.
Go on.
No, no, go ahead, Bonnie.
What happened to the oil, the Exxon or Humble Oil that he...
Right, it's now Exxon, exactly. Well, it's, I gather it's still flowing. Mm. They wanted the money from the oil. They were just typical Texas oil people. Not and Claiborne refused ever to be called an oil man, did not like to be called an oil man.
Right.
And quickly, his relationship with LBJ?
Ah, his brother, you right. see, yeah. when his brother went to Congress, Richard Claiborne went to Congress in the early 1930s, he took with him as his secretary Lyndon Johnson. So Lyndon Johnson first went to Washington at the behest of the Claibergues. Then as time went on and Lyndon Johnson saw better fields for himself and political corruption of various kinds, he broke with Richard Claiborne, and Claiborne lost. And I think people in Texas, that's another topic, people in Texas say, Lyndon Johnson doesn't want you to win, you don't win.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. We've been speaking with English professor at Temple University, Joan Mellon. We've been talking about her latest book, The Great Game in Cuba, How the CIA Sabotaged Its Own Plot to Unseat Fidel Castro. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Thank
Joseph
you.
And Bonnie.
Thanks so
Thank
much.
Thank you so much.
And that wraps up today's edition. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction by Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and digital downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, more information, including author and book links, such as today's, at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like, won't you? Again, tomorrow's program chronicles the Ben Novak family. The patriarch opened Miami Beach's most famous hotel in 1954, the Fontainebleau. His widow and son were savagely murdered by Ben Jr.'s wife and others in 2009. The book is The Prince of Paradise. And the calendar on this day in 1452, 561 years ago, the birth of Leonardo da Vinci. His Mona Lisa and The Last Supper are the most famous paintings in history. Da Vinci foresaw the helicopter, the tank, and also solar power. And on this day in 1947, 66 years ago, Jackie Robinson breaks the Major League color line and goes hitless in his first game against the Boston Braves in Brooklyn. Robinson did score a run. And one more while we say the 1988 Mickey D's slogan, good time, great taste, that's why this is our place. On this day in 1955, 58 years ago, the first franchised McDonald's opens in Des Plaines, Illinois. Ray Kroc had bought the idea from the McDonald brothers in California. A burger, 15 cents. Fries, a dime. A shake, 20 cents. Our theme music created by Michael Levine. And we leave with a thought from Ray Kroc. Luck is a dividend of sweat. The more you sweat, the luckier you get. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.